Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
This is Radio Freedom.
KLF is gonna rock you.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time, where we speak to some of the most influential figures in music about the pivotal first moments that shaped their lives and careers, the events that led them to be where and who they are today.
KLF is gonna rock you.
It's really hard to know how to describe Bill Drummond. He was in 70s art punk band Big in Japan before becoming the manager and record label boss, providing an idiosyncratic hand to the careers of 80s heroes like Echo and the Bunnymen and the Teardrop Explodes. Then things get really interesting. He wrote the definitive manual on how to get a number one single. He created, then destroyed, Stadium Rave with the KLF, and he burnt £1 million. He's constantly questioning his relationship with music and deconstructing the way we experience and interact with it. He's also one of the most perceptive, interesting and scarily intelligent people I've ever interviewed, as you'll hear.
We start these interviews in the same way for everyone. We always ask everyone, when were they first aware of music?
There's 3 points. There isn't just one answer to this. I can remember going to a Christmas party at Penningham Prison in Southwest Scotland when I must have been 3 years old, and my father was the chaplain to the prison. So it was a Christmas party for all the children of the officers and anybody connected to the prison. Now, I guess I would have known what church music was and pipe band music was at that age, because that was naturally in our life. But we didn't have a record player. I wasn't aware of a record. Well, we didn't have a record player at home. I can't remember music on the radio. But at this the Christmas party for the kids at the prison, there was this thing that happened on stage. There was a man who had a box in front of him here, and there was a kind of wooden bit that stuck out of the box, and there were some strings on it, and he was bashing this thing. And it was the loudest noise I'd ever heard. And there was somebody else who got this thing that my granny used to wash the clothes, and he was making a load of noise on that. And then there was a tea chest with a broom handle in the corner and a string, and he was plucking that. And it was just it was just this wall of noise, but it was the most exciting noise I'd ever heard in my life. And it was only afterwards, and it made me want to jump up and down, but it was only afterwards I thought, that's maybe music. That's maybe music as well as the music, church music, or... I mean, I didn't think in terms of church music being music. But somehow that was the first lasting impression of experiencing music. And nothing since has ever seemed as loud. And of course, I can look back at that and think, well, none of that would have been amplified. And for those that don't know, it was a skiffle band. And it must be 1957 or 56, maybe.
Now, this here's a story about the Rock Island Line. Now, Rock Island Line, she runs down into New Orleans. And just outside of New Orleans, there's a big toll gate. And all the trains, they go through the toll gate while they gotta pay the man some money. But of course, if you got certain things on board, you're okay, you don't have to pay the man nothing. And just now, we see a train, she's coming down the line. And when she come up near the toll gate, the driver, he shout down to the man. He say, I got pigs, I got horses, I got cows. I got sheep, I got all livestock, I got all livestock, I got all livestock. And the man say, well, you're all right, boy, just get on through, you don't have to pay me nothing. And the train go through. And when you go through the toll gate, the train get up a little bit of steam and a little bit of speed. And when the driver think he's safely on the other side, he shout back down the line to the man. He said, I fooled you, I fooled you, I got pig iron, I got pig iron, I got all. Now tell you where I'm going, boy. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride, yes. The Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Oh, maybe right, maybe wrong. You know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone.
First music that you owned that was actually yours to play and treasure and do with what you wished?
You see, you're making a fundamental mistake there. You're saying, what was the first piece of recorded music? As if that somehow has a prime thing. I owned music from the word go. I was owning that music that I heard. But if you're asking me, what is the first record I owned? First record I bought was on the 17th of February 1967, and it was Penny Lane back by Strawberry Fields, and I bought it in the HMV record shop in Corby, Northamptonshire, at 4:47.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go stop and say hey.
take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Living is easy with eyes closed, misunderstanding. Take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. No. It must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in, but it's alright. That is, I think it's not too bad. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Always know, sometimes think it's me, but you know I know when it's a dream. I think I know, I mean, yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree. Take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever.
What do you remember from listening to that track for the first time?
I got home, I asked my mum, because we just got, my mum had got a Dance at Monarch record player for Christmas, and she got the Sound of Music soundtrack. My sister got some boring jazz album, my father had got an EP by Jimmy Shand and the band. So I got this record, I brought it home, I asked her if I could put the record player on, I plugged it in, switched on, but I'd never actually put a record on before. I'd seen people do it, and it's one of those ones that you got a spindle, you could stack up 4 or 5 7-inch singles, so it was a bit hard to get it down. And then I realised there was the speeds, you know, because, you know, 33, 45, 78, but I got it at the right speed, And it took quite a bit to pluck up courage to put the record into the needle into the groove. And Austin, just after I put it in, I'd seen Top of the Pops. You know, I knew that some people leapt around to pop music, and I also knew some people, you know, thought about pop music. And I didn't know if I should be one of the people that leaps around to pop music or one of the people that should think about it. So if I was going to think about it, maybe I should sit back on the sofa and just think about what I was listening to. But anyway, I got the needle into the groove. The music started, and for that first, you know, the three minutes, 29 seconds that the record lasts, all I was thinking was, I own this record. This is my record. This is my... And I played it three times before I realised I got a B-side as well. Remembered, I own the B-side as well.
What about performance? Because you said there's this delineation between being a passive listener or a performer or someone that should maybe think about this. When was your first... Can you remember performing, not necessarily music... performing in front of a crowd or four people or doing something for the benefit or the appreciation of someone other than just yourself?
Yeah, again, I'm afraid I've got to have to...
Please.
Not bring you to account.
Please.
But one of my problems with music is I've always felt music should be not the performers and the consumers, that it should be really a thing that we're all part of. And I guess that's because it's only a 20th century thing. When the evolution of recording technology, so music could be recorded, that's when it pushed music into being a thing that you either do or you sit and listen to. Before the beginning of the 20th century, music was, I mean, of course you had the great piano players or the great violinists, you know, the Paganinis and that. But it was more of a thing you did all together. So that is, I'm just skirting around the answer. The answer is, I sang in a church choir when I was a kid.
Okay, well, let's say your first communal music experience, where you were with like-minded souls.
I'd be church when I was a kid, yeah. And then in school. But if you're asking me when did I first get up on stage with an electric guitar and make a lot of noise, that's a different question.
I'm asking that question.
Okay. That would be when I was about 14.
What do you remember from it?
It was in the Girl Guide Hall, and some friends of ours at school had a band. And because I could play a few chords, I went up and met up with them. And it was Sunday afternoon. It was a fantastic feeling.
The kind of story of your life and career seems to kind of... Well, it's music and art in parallel. Can you remember your first piece of art, I suppose? You could. Were you always quite interested in the visual as well as... aural arts?
Yes, definitely. My dad did watercolour paintings, so that was his way of escaping and relaxing. So I'd often go off with him into the countryside near where we lived while he's off doing watercolour paintings, and I'd be climbing trees. So I was very aware of that as a process ever since I can remember. And we used to go down and stay with my granny in Norwich. We used to go to the museum there in the castle, and they'd got all these watercolour paintings and big oil paintings. Norwich School, it's called. Early 19th century. So that had a big impact on me. And I was into drawing at school. You know, I was always into drawing. I ended up going to art school because I could draw.
So do you see the art and the music as mutually...
Well, the music thing was never, that was never planned, that was an accident. That happened, you know, even though I mentioned about, you know, being able to play guitar a bit as a teenager and making a load of noise, I never had dreams of being a rock star or anything. That was purely accidental, you know, when I was 23 or 24, that started happening.
So you got big in Japan with your first recognised band.
Yeah. And that was when I was 23. I was in 77.
I used to hang around old nights in the dark. I used to dream of what we'd be in the world in that school.
Bye. dancing all around.
Wasn't supposed to be a serious thing. It was never. It wasn't like we were trying to be, you know, we've read The Enemy and we want to be one of these bands. It was sitting in a pub in Matthew Street in Liverpool called The Grapes, and there was myself and this guy called Clive Langer, who went on to become a producer, a successful producer, and he was in a band called Deaf School at the time. He was kind of the main musician in this band called Deaf School, who are from Liverpool, who were also from the art college, but I left a couple of years before that. And he was going on to me and these other two guys who kind of worked with Deaf School. One designed their sleeves and one was the brother of the lead singer, and also he was a roadie. And he was saying, you've got to form a band. And so he was telling us, and they were just about to go off on an American tour. He says, you can have our equipment while we're away in America, because they were going to hire equipment out there. And when we get back in 3 weeks' time, I want you to be a band, and I'll join you. And so that was the beginning of Big in Japan. And it was kind of high. We only lasted a year, and lineup kept changing, evolving, and but I guess it was great in a way.
You kind of formally, I suppose, joined the music industry when you formed Zoo Records and managed Echo and the Bunnymen, Teardrop Explodes. What was the first mistake you made as a record label boss?
Seymour Stein, who owned Sire Records, or co-owned Sire Records, and they had Talking Heads and Ramones. So obviously they're kind of big in one sense, you know, influential acts of the time, you know, late 70s. He was yet to sign Madonna, but he was going to do it in a couple of years. He approached us about signing Echo and the Bunnymen, and I remember writing a long, detailed letter to Seymour saying, "Well, this is all very well, you know, we'd be up for talking to you about this, but you have to understand, if they sign to your label, they will not make albums." You know, I was totally against albums. As far as I was concerned, albums were the worst thing that had ever happened to music, and I compromised on that. And he said to me, well, Bill, you know, it's a far bigger, the music industry is, you know, right now is defined by album sales. Or he didn't go completely into it. He said, I can't change that. That's the way it works. So that was one thing. I compromised that. I allowed Echo and the Bunnymen to record albums. Obviously, they wanted to record albums, but, you know, I was totally against the idea of albums. And the other thing was that Tony Wilson, who had Factory Records in Manchester, and I had built a rapport between the two of us over the previous 18 months, 2 years. And he was always telling me, you must never sign your bands to major labels in London. And I used to say to him, well, that's all very well for you to say that, Tony. You've got, you know, you've got a comfortable job in Granada TV, you know. We're all on the dole, you know. So, but he was adamant we shouldn't have anything to do with those people down in London. Because I wasn't from Liverpool, I didn't have this fierce sense of Liverpudlian pride or anything. But he might have been right. So maybe those are two mistakes.
I'm Matt Everett. This is The First Time.
Six Music.
BBC Six Music.
Right now, it's time to sing out the jams.
I reach a positive vibe, a way of life is how I'm living. So get hyped to the rhythm. KLF is the crew you hear, yeah. Design a rhyme, I just won't fear. Back to react, enough is enough. Let me ask you a question. What time is love? What time is love? We'll be right back.
you been after. I make you shake to break you, take to right in the path for what they call the moo moo. KLF, boy, we come rough. Bring the break. What time is love? Time is love.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time, where we look at the pivotal first moments that made some of our greatest musical artists who they are today. Today we're speaking to musician, manager, producer, writer and conceptual arts terrorist, Mr. Bill Drummond.
What was the first thing on the agenda of the KLF?
The first record that we did together was called All You Need Is Love? And it was only going to be a one-off. It was just an idea that I had about what you could do with samplers, kind of. It was also, I loved the fact that rap, early hip-hop, rap, had seemed to completely they were presenting a complete new way of putting music together. And I like the fact that we could just get rid of rock music, everything rock music had represented. You know, the whole guitar, bass, drums, lead singer, you know, that whole mythology that goes with it. I loved the fact that that could all just be dispensed with. And I didn't want us to be making music that was mimicking what American hip-hop or R&B, not R&B, hip-hop or rap acts were doing, but to try and make a British version of it. And that's what we aimed to do right at the beginning. Obviously, it evolved in all sorts of different directions, but that was right at the beginning. And that was the only thing, really. And I remember it started by, I went through my record collection at the time, noting down the key every song was in, and the BPM, the beats per minute, of every song, and making these cross-referencing things. So I could see if you could take 2 seconds of that, you know, something by James Brown, and you could put 2 seconds of that by ABBA, and you could cut and splice them together. I mean, we didn't have, obviously, the sampling, the digital technology to do all that then. You would actually have to splice these things together. But theoretically, it could work, and I like the idea of building things up like that and completely rethinking the whole way music has been put together.
Tell me about your first book, which I believe was The Manual. Is that right? In
the first book I wrote?
Well, was that published. The first book you wrote?
It's the first book... it was the first book published, The Manual, yes.
Okay, which was How to Have a Number One, 19...
The Easy Way.
1988. No, How to Have a Number One, the Easy Way. Yeah. How do people react to that? Because it obviously worked.
Well, they still do. This is, it really surprises me. It hasn't been...
Hasn't been in print for a long time.
It hasn't been in print for a long time. And we often get asked by publishers, do you want to reprint it? And Jimmy and I always say, no. I know, obviously, it exists on the net. It's there. People want the information. But its influence carries on and on and on. Which, in one sense, I find surprising. Obviously, I guess I'm flattered. I don't know how well it stands up now, but I also know one of the influences for me behind wanting to write it, there's a book called Play Power by Richard Neville, which came out in about 1970 or 69-70. And that, for me, was a book that sort of said, you can do what you want. I mean, it wasn't... You don't have to wait to be given permission. And I kind of wanted the manual to be like that. Don't wait for somebody to say, yes, you're allowed to make pop music now. Or, yes, you've been sanctioned, you know. We've signed you to this record label, so you're now official. Oh, you've been written about in the NME, so we will venerate you. You know, sod all that. If you want to do it, go and do it. So that was kind of the ethos behind it. And that thing about having a number one, just doing it for the almost the sake of doing it.
When did you realise that the KLF were to be no more?
Everybody knows that bands or singers, they have a natural life. And usually there's only a couple of good albums in them. I mean, some people, you know, you might get into a certain artist and you enjoy following their career. But usually it is pretty early on in their career that they make their defining record. And that's got faster and faster. You know, it's like if you haven't done it by your third album, you're not going to... And I just thought, now pop music, you know, and we both thought, it should be short term, and let's stop now. Now, we had actually got some plans for other things, but we realised, no, let's just stop now. And there's also other things we wanted to do that have nothing to do with music. And music is a very jealous mistress.
I do have to ask about another first. I have to ask, what was the first emotion you felt when you were setting fire to that first note of that alleged 1 million?
After it had been done, and about a year or so later, there was a... We had this film. We actually filmed the whole thing, all however long it took. And we started showing that film at places, and we felt we owed it to, at least to our families, to come up with a reason why you do something like that. And when we showed the film, when we went out with it, all people wanted to know was, did you really do it? You know, well, it could be fake, or this, you know, come up with all these things. And we realised it didn't matter how much we said or attempted to prove that this was, no, this is for real. This is... The ones that didn't want to believe would not believe, and the ones that wanted to believe would want to believe. And the other thing everybody wanted to know was why. And we soon realised whatever... And we felt we should come up with a reason. We should, you do something like that, you've got to be able to justify it. And we realised that there was no way... There was never a reason that was good enough for people. So we decided, this is not down to us, it's down to other people. They've got to come up with a reason. They've got to come up with a reason why somebody should want to go, or why two people should want to go and burn £1 million. And then somebody who we were working with suggested to us, look, you've got to stop talking about it. The more you talk about it, the more it waters it down, dissipates it. You've got to... We've got to have a moratorium for a certain amount of time, give people enough time to take on board this thing, and then they can come up with reasons why this had to be done, or why anybody would want to do this. I know I haven't answered your questions, but
That'll do.
That's the answer I'm giving.
That'll do.
Not a good enough answer for my children, though, I tell you that.
Let's talk about the 17 Project for a bit. So the 17 Project involved you bringing together groups of 17 people into a kind of into a choir from groups, similar social or professional groups, and getting them to form a piece of music that, for once, that would never be recorded, that would only exist for the time of that performance. What was the first one like?
I first did it as a trial in Leicester.
Why Leicester?
Because I've got a friend there who's got a studio. He's called Kev Reverb. He had a band.
Kev Reverb's a good name.
Yeah. And so I said to Kev, look, I got this, there's this noise I can hear in my head, and it's a choral thing. And as I maybe mentioned earlier, you know, I sang in choirs as a kid. Choral music's always been a kind of thing, and a natural thing for me to listen to and think about. And so that's, I put together something there with him. So that goes back 2004. And initially, it was to kind of make a kind of very primal sounding choir that didn't use lyrics, didn't use song structure, didn't use rhythm, dispensed with, it was almost like starting music again. But I wanted to use big, big chords. You know, I could hear these sounds in my head, and it was wanting to put that together. And I tried it once as a performance in front of an audience and realised that was a mistake. You know, I wanted the 17, when it's done, it's always with a different group of people, and it's just done for the people that are taking part. So there's never an audience. So there can never be a music business structure that can embrace what I'm doing here. But it's not quite just how you mentioned it. You know, there's lots of different scores that can be performed by the 17, which I've been doing all around the world. And some are hardly music. Like one of the ones I did it in Port-au-Prince in Haiti a week before Christmas, and I did it in Beijing in the autumn, where I get 100 people, get a map of the city, I draw a circle on the map, and the circumference of the circle is 5 kilometres. I walk around placing each one of these 100 at 50-metre intervals all the way around. So it's quite a bit of commitment that's needed from the people taking part. And once you've got everybody on this circle, and everybody's got to be able to see that the person 50 metres one side of them and 50 metres the other, and you get the first one to go, whoa, to the next one, and they've got to carry on the way out to the next one, and it goes all the way around. And by the time it gets back to the end, and you can hear it coming in the distance, getting closer and closer to you, it's a great feeling. But you get it to go around 5 times, and that's the piece. That's all there is to it. So there's no music there to sing and dance to, but once you've done it, it's a great feeling, and it kind of more exists in the memory of having done it. Whereas other ones that are more like you described, where I did a. It was 2008 in Derby. We did a really big one there that involved 1,700 people. And it was 100 groups of 17, but it was each 17 was made up of like 17 nurses, 17 lollipop ladies, 17 taxi drivers. So it was a real cross-section of Derby. And this was to celebrate I was commissioned to put this together, celebrate the opening of a big new art centre there. And we put this whole thing together with this mass amount of people. For this one, it was using recording technology, and each group, you just get them to sing one note for 5 minutes and build this whole thing up. And then you get everybody back on a certain date, which we did in the marketplace in the middle of Derby, and they hear it back through a big PA, and then it's deleted, it's gone. That's it.
It's glorious, but it's quite sad. But that's one of the reasons probably why it's glorious. It's a stupid question, but you've kind of answered it by your enthusiasm for the things you've been talking about. You're not tempted to make music for mass public consumption anymore at all, because there is a beauty in giving something and making it available forever, not deleting it, not making it a one-off.
It'd be crap. it'd be rubbish, you know, and everybody knows, we all know. It's a zeitgeist thing as well. It's not just one's own talents. If one has talent, it has to be at that right time with whatever else is going around, which defines, I mean, the mistake most artists make, they think it's them that's the great ones. In actual fact, they're just part of something. They're just part of a thing that was happening at a certain time. I don't know if that makes sense.
We have to finish the list of all these first, and we do finish the last. The end is we ask someone to pick a piece of music to finish. It can be whatever you feel like.
Fairport Convention's Who Knows Where the Time Goes.
Why?
It's because it's one of the greatest songs ever written. And that's the one that came into my head then.
Thank you very much.
Sky. All the birds are leaving, but how can they know it's time for them to go? Your fickle friends are leaving. Oh, but then you know it's time for them to go. I have no fear of time.
Six Music.
As your Sunday afternoon slides into Sunday evening, our raison d'être is to tease out the joie de vivre of the weekend.
Je suis enchanté.
Amy LeMay.
We're given carte blanche to play whatever we need to find that special vibe, you know, a certain je ne sais quoi. And for this show, a level of tête-à-tête is de rigueur. It's very much a little bit me and a little bit you. And of course, the music, that's très, très bon.
This is...
Quelle surprise! This is Six Music, after all.
Amy LeMay.
It's kind of weird and absolutely wonderful. Listen every Sunday afternoon from 4
on BBC Radio Six Music.
It's wicked. Those that don't know how to be pros get evicted. A woman could bear you, break you, take you. Now it's time to rhyme. Can you relate to a sister dope enough to make you holler and scream?
Yo, let me take it from here, queen. Excuse me, but I think I'm about due to get into precisely what I am about to do. I'm conversating to the folks who have no whatsoever clue. So listen very carefully as I break it down for you. Merrily, 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 hype and happy overjoyed. Please, with all the beats and rhymes my sisters have employed. Look, as we're throwing down the sound totally a yes. Let me state the position. Ladies first, yes?
Yes.
Cause when it's time for loving, it's the woman that gets them sworn. Stepping, strutting, moving on, rhyming, cutting, and not forgetting. We are the ones to give birth to the new generation of prophets, cause it's late.
I break into a lyrical freestyle. Grab the mic, look at the crowd and see smiles. Cause they see a woman standing up on her own two. Sloppy slouching is something I won't do. Some think that we can't flow.
Can't flow.
Stereotypes, they got to go.
Got to go.